Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, the box office has a big win. The Bike Riders hits theaters, and director Jeff Nichols joins the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Blenders, and welcome to episode number 311 of Real Blend, a podcast that felt every emotion at the movie theaters this past week. On this week's show, the box office has a huge win thanks to Inside Out 2. The Bike Riders is hitting theaters, and director Jeff Nichols joins the show for a very, very fun interview. Apparently, Kevin didn't get the memo. It's Steven Spielberg t-shirt day. Kevin,
what happened? Wow. Yeah, I know. I had one for War of the Worlds ready to go. Right. I just didn't. I was on my bed this morning.
Right.
And I just really, I mean, that, or I had a terminal hat I could have worn too.
Okay. But
you could be in Catch Me If You Can right now. You know, there were a lot of suits in that.
Yeah, a lot of suits in that as well too. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, you didn't wear the t-shirt.
He's cosplaying.
Yes. Hi, I'm Sean O'Connell, the managing editor of Cinema Blend, joined as always by Kevin McCarthy of Fox 5 in Washington, D.C., and Gabe Kovach, our producer. Jake is going to be joining us momentarily on the other side of the interview. But thank you very much for coming at us this week. We're really happy to be able to talk about Inside Out 2 and the success that it has had at the box office, coming off the heels of Bad Boys Ride or Die, which also had a very good time at the box office. So maybe we are pushing back on this narrative of box office woes and everybody heading in the opposite direction. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. In the meantime, if you would like to see which Spielberg t-shirts Gabe and I decided to wear this week, head over to our YouTube channel. We're at youtube.com/RealBlendPodcast. Last week was a newsletter week for people who sign up for Real Blend Premium. So if you want to hop on that train, go to head to the descriptions on the show here, and it'll tell you how to sign up to become a Real Blend Premium member. And in the meantime, we were talking recently when we had, who was it who came on the show? Who was a first timer? Gabe, who did we have that Jake just did that was a first timer?
Richard Linklater.
It was Linklater. Yeah. And we were surprised at how often we are adding newcomers to the show. Jeff Nichols is also a newcomer. Isn't that right?
Yeah.
We've had Michael Shannon on the show, and he talked at length about his collaborations with Jeff. But Jeff has a new movie coming out. Actually, it's weird to call it new because I feel like we've been hearing about this movie for a really long time.
Was it last summer it was originally supposed to be released?
Well,
or was it just last fall?
It went to the fall film festivals.
Yeah.
It was in Telluride and I want to say Venice. And then it was supposed to, it actually went down to Savannah, but one of the days that I was there, it screened on one of the days that I was not there.
Mm-hmm.
But again, last year in the fall, the strike was happening. None of the actors could really promote the film. This has an all-star cast, including Austin Butler, Jodie Comer, Tom Hardy, Michael Shannon ends up popping up in it. So you can understand why they would want to get those people out promoting it. And then now recently we've seen, Kev, I think about this all the time. Whenever you mention that, like, the value of an actor on the red carpet, you know, what that brings. And just Austin Butler talking to journalists has done so much for bike riders to put it on people's radar. So so we were thrilled to get Jeff Nichols to join us on the show. Let's throw it to that interview right now on behalf of the bike riders, and then we'll pick up on the other side. Hopefully we'll have Jake with us, and then we can get into some box office talk and a bike riders review. So we'll see you on the other side. This is Jeff Nichols joining us on the Real Blend podcast on behalf of the new film, The Bike Riders.
Doing well, man. Seriously, Jeff, this is an absolute honor. Thank you for joining the Real Blend podcast. The spiel we always give off the top is that we created this show because we became frustrated interviewing amazing filmmakers for 4 minutes at a time. So we really wanted to sort of get into the nitty gritty nerdy stuff that oftentimes the TV slots don't allow. So seriously, welcome to the show and thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. I get frustrated giving 4 minute interviews.
Fair. I bet so. I know.
Yesterday, so.
I know you had that whole day yesterday. I'm going to jump into this, and it's kind of a fun question, but also meant to be, you know, very real. I feel like next to saying I can ride a horse, I can ride a motorcycle is probably one of the skills most lied about by actors on their resume. So I'm sort of curious, were there any actors who showed up on the set of this film with far less riding skills than maybe they had previously advertised?
Well, you know, to be fair to the actors, even guys that said they had riding experience had trouble with these bikes. It was really about the bikes. You know, these things. I mean, we had bikes from the 1940s. You know, it's 60, 70 year old pieces of machinery. And it wasn't until the early 70s that the United States formalized the setup of a bike. So where the throttle is, where the brake is, where the clutch is. So all these bikes are set up differently. You've got suicide shifters, you know, on the gas tanks. You've got, you know, sometimes the brake is on the right, sometimes on the left. And so honestly, it was harder for some of the guys who were more experienced riders, because they're, you know, used to the traditional setup of a bike, to then come in and be like, no, you're going to, you know, pat your head and rub your belly the other way. And so all of them, to be honest, all of them had to go through training. Now some guys, you know, took to it better than others. Sadly for everyone, Michael Shannon wasn't allowed, you know, to get near our motorcycle. We barely let him lean on a motorcycle.
That just spells trouble.
You know, when we made Midnight Special, he didn't even have a driver's license. And it was like, oh, we gotta teach Mike how to drive in this chase. He's great. I mean, he's obviously a genius and super talented. So I imagine had we put him on a bike, he would have learned it very quickly. But that was one of the first questions he asked me. He's like, I don't have to learn how to ride, do I?
Just fight. You have to learn how to fight. Jeff, the last time I felt a similar vibe from a movie as I got watching Bike Riders, honestly, goes all the way back to Francis Ford Coppola's adaptation of The Outsiders. I don't know if it's the Midwestern location of it, the camaraderie, you know, of the group, of the gang together, the fights as well, too. When the fights were sort of broke up, they had that visceral impact to it. I'm curious if that movie had any impact on you at an early age, the way that it affected me, or if you can see any of the DNA of it in Bike Riders.
100%. So basically the first 3 minutes of that movie, which is all set to Gloria by then, which is Matt Dillon, you know, sitting there smoking a cigarette. And what are you guys getting up to? I don't know, nothing legal. And it goes all the way, you know, through them grabbing that deck of playing cards. You ever play 52 card pickup?
Yeah.
What? Hey,
what?
Hey,
what?
Don't be smart. You know? And then they go to that kind of drive-in and there's a scuffle. And before they go to the drive-in movie theater, you know, they go to the diner first. And my whole goal in life was just to take that 3 minutes and make an entire movie out of it, you know? Awesome. And that's really, the Bike Riders is my best attempt. Because there's something even in the way he shot that, the colors, you know, there's that low angle tracking shot when they're walking up to the diner, the car hop diner, and there's big puffy white clouds in the sky. I think they shot it. I guess they shot it in Oklahoma. And just the look and feel and the texture of it, everybody looked right. Everybody felt right. You know? And I've been wanting to do that. Yeah. My whole career, and the Bike Riders was my chance.
Well, you did it. Absolutely, man. I couldn't stop thinking about Coppola's movie during yours.
Yeah. I mean, and S.E. Hinton's books are really incredible, you know, on their own. But to have Coppola interpret that, yeah, it's undeniable.
That's awesome. There's a small detail near the end of the film that I thought was fascinating, which is that one of the characters is paid $5 to sit on his bike in front of a theater and basically convince people to go see Easy Rider. And I feel like that's such an interesting statement on the impact that our culture has on movies and the movies have on our culture. So I guess I have sort of a little bit of a chicken or the egg question. Do you think that the biker culture impacted Hollywood, or did Hollywood impact the biker culture? Because there is a massive difference between the culture that's represented in Easy Rider and the culture that's represented in The Wild One.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't find two different films, even if you just look at it aesthetically. You know, you've got The Wild One opening with Marlon Brando on a fake bike with rear projection photography behind him, looking pretty cheesy, to be honest.
I do love it, though.
And then you've got, you know, this insane drug fueled, you know, early 70s movie that it basically, you know, recounts that counterculture better than any movie from that period. I think the whole point is there's a feedback loop, you know, they start to inform each other. It came from Danny Lyon's book that the real Johnny who started the Chicago Outlaws was watching Marlon Brando on TV in The Wild One. There's a photograph in the book of this guy's scrapbook, and he has the TV guide with Marlon Brando on the cover that we recreated in the film. Like, that was real. That really happened. The detail about getting paid to sit outside of Easy Rider, that's one of the few things that I grabbed from a source outside of the book. I'd read it somewhere online, and I was like, well, that, I got to have that. Because what it really represents is how this club and these clubs have kind of become an affectation of themselves, like a projection of themselves. And the new guys that are joining are actually joining for different reasons than the original guys.
Mm-hmm.
The guys were just, I don't know, they were kind of normal guys. They were just working class guys. They liked to drink beer. They had jobs. They were truck drivers. You know, they were all kinds of working class guys. And they just wanted to ride around and drink beer on motorcycles. But then by the end of this thing, all that's changed. And the reason these people are joining up to this club are much more nefarious.
Mm.
And that trajectory is the trajectory of the film, but it was also in the book. You know, Danny writes that at some point in the mid 60s, the club split. It split between the beer drinkers and the pot smokers. Mm. And that was very real. So you've got these guys that look like greasers from the 1950s. And then you got these guys that look like, honestly, contemporary gutter punks, you know, that could have been, you know, stumbled out of an 80s punk rock film.
Yeah.
And so it is a generational divide that is kind of, I don't know, brought into stark contrast just by, you know, Tom Hardy's character walking into this party at the end of the film, and he's still got a greased haircut and nobody else does around him. He's the wrong guy in the wrong time now.
Yeah.
All of it's only been 8 years.
Wow.
Yeah, but to that end, I want to bring up Toby Wallace because, you know, a month from now, despite all the famous faces that you have in your cast, like, his character of the kid is the one I'm going to remember, you know, and his effort to join the group is the one that really stood out to me the most. And, you know, I'm not going to really reveal any of the details about it, but what did you see in him? What made him right for that part?
Well, I think Toby's a movie star, you know, the world just doesn't know it yet, but I think they will. I saw him in an Australian film with Ben Mendelsohn called Baby Teeth.
Okay.
And honestly, it's the last time I cried watching a movie. You got to watch this film. He plays a drug addict in it. And he does. He looks like a stray dog, which is how I imagined that character. You know, that's one of the few characters in the film that is completely cut from whole creative cloth. You know, I needed a physical character to represent the world that was coming, you know, the danger that was coming. And that became the kid. And after seeing Baby Teeth, I was like, man, this guy feels like, you watch that movie and you're like, I don't know, is this guy a real actor? Like, did they just find this guy on the street? Because he is so natural. And he is a real actor. He's just that good of one. And, you know, he was sitting in the makeup chair right before we started filming. He's like, how do you want my hair? I was like, I want you to look like a mangy dog. And he just grabbed the clippers from the hairstylist and just took a chunk of hair out of the side of his head, you know? And it's like, this kid's going to do just fine.
The moment when he turns, when his mom sort of confronts him as he's leaving the kitchen, is the most scared I felt for a character in your movie.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I mean, he's dangerous.
Incredible. And that's our good friend Mookie, who plays his mother. She's an incredible actress out of Chicago. And, you know, we did a couple different takes, and she just did this one where she starts to cover her face. Like, you just know that she's terrified of her own child.
Yeah.
And you know that there has been violence in the past, and it is, and all Toby does is just turn around and look at her.
Yeah.
But he looks dead inside. Like his eyes look dead. And it's crazy because he's such a, if you meet him, he's just this kind of vibrant, goofy young guy, you know, but he's a great actor.
That's awesome. If you can't tell, I'm talking to you from Chicago right now. So this is a movie that everyone in our city is very excited about. There is a great story of producer Al Ruddy, who recently passed away just a couple of days ago, literally meeting with the mafia to ease their concerns about The Godfather, because they weren't happy about it when they were in production. I'm sort of curious. I don't really know what is the status of the Chicago Outlaws today? Like, are there any remnants of that club remaining? Was there anyone for you to meet and potentially address any concerns of the film?
Yeah, I mean, the Outlaws are, as far as I'm aware, the second largest motorcycle gang in the world. You know, they have chapters in Europe, they have chapters in Australia, they have chapters all over the place. To be quite honest, I'm terrified of them. I really didn't want to cross paths with those guys, and I certainly didn't want to offend them or upset them at all. Which was one of the main reasons we fictionalized the club. You know, we fictionalized the patch because we didn't want to step on anybody's toes. Mm. These guys take their colors very, very seriously. And so we knew kind of from the beginning that we would need to fictionalize this thing. So there were no official meetings or anything like that. I've heard, you know, through different people, I've kind of heard, yeah, they know about it, and you know, there was really nothing for them to be super offended about, hopefully. So I think they're, you know, okay with it. But no official channels. And that's one reason why it took me so long to adapt this, because I was trying to figure out the balance between fictionalizing, you know, because there's so many good details in the book that I want to use, but how much of those can I use while not stepping on the toes of the Outlaws? And this is the balance that I came up with. And I have to say too, you know, I didn't want to tell their story. Not that, you know, it wouldn't be an interesting story to tell, but, you know, I just come off of Loving, where I wanted to be extremely respectful of everything that happened to the Lovings, partly because I'm a white guy born in the late 70s. I just didn't want to make stuff up, you know, for that film. I wanted stuff that I could prove out. And through research, but I didn't want that responsibility on this. If it wasn't in Danny's book, I didn't care about it. Every time I went to Google things, you know, about other biker culture stuff, I just got freaked out, and it just wasn't stuff I was interested in. Mm. Because the truth is, I'm not really interested in biker culture. What I'm interested in was the people that Danny interviewed in 1965, and these guys that talked about not feeling like they belonged in the mainstream, the guys that talked about their jobs, their bikes, you know, their lives and their parents and everything else. That's what really got me going, you know. When you combine it then with the bikes and the clothes and the hair and the music and everything else, it's a complete package. But it was really, you know, Danny's ability to go in and get these guys to open up and talk about themselves, and Kathy, you know, his ability to take and ingratiate himself to working class people. That's what I wanted to make a movie about.
Yeah. To that end, Jeff, the line that really resonated with me is when one of the biker characters is just trying to sort of figure out why riders are ostracized. And he says, everybody needs somebody to pick on. And it's this great little philosophical aside, you know, that kind of gets mixed in the conversation. And I was like, God, that's everything. That's the whole movie. If that feels like the movie, you know. And I'm kind of curious how you identify with that belief. Like, what does that line mean to you?
Well, I love that line. And I actually, that's another one. I took that line from a 1960s interview I found on YouTube with some Hell's Angels. You know, everybody needs somebody to pick on. Can you think of anybody better than us? And what I found interesting, when you start getting to the psychology of these guys, they've made a very willful decision to separate themselves from mainstream society. They don't like it. They talk about it being bougie and owning houses and paying a mortgage. And I don't want that life. That's not me. I don't want that. And you hear all these quotes like that. I don't want to own a car and, you know, have a wife and kids. Like, that seems like prison. I don't want that. But then they sound hurt that mainstream society doesn't accept them. It's this crazy. Like, well, wait a second. You're saying all this stuff that you, you know, you hate mainstream society, but then you get your feelings hurt when they reject you. You can't have it both ways, you know? And I found that kind of fascinating. I don't really know how I particularly identify with it, but what I'm looking for when I'm making films is I'm looking for unique human behavior. And that's, that just was odd to me. And I wanted it represented because it's true. Like, well, I don't know why they feel that way, but they do. And it's also, you know, when you're looking at human nature, why are we attracted to things that are dangerous? You know, if you take a motorcycle as an example, you look at them and they're beautiful and you want to get on one, you want to ride one, and it can kill you. It can kill you very easily. So what is that about us? Like, why are we built that way? And Kathy's that way, and Benny's that way, and Johnny's that way. And I think a lot of people live that way. And the film doesn't necessarily answer that question, but it certainly holds it up to the light.
Jeff, I think the casting in this movie is one of the best ensemble casts I've seen in a long time. Every person is so genuinely authentic to their part. But there is an expression amongst film fans that is used sometimes that I think is hilarious that I would love to get your thoughts on. And it's called the iPhone face. And it's where would they say a younger actor doesn't fit into a period piece because they have a face that has clearly seen an iPhone before. So when you are casting younger actors who have to blend in to a 60s or a 70s aesthetic, is there such a thing as an actor who just looks like they don't belong there? Or is that just a thing that film Twitter has made up?
I don't know. I didn't spend time thinking about actors that didn't belong there. I just spent time thinking about actors that would.
Sure.
And, you know, the approach that I took with Francine Maisler, my casting director, who honestly, I should say, is probably one of the most powerful people in Hollywood. Like, nobody ever talks about casting directors, but like, we got studio heads calling this woman, you know, saying like, hey, can you please call this actor for us? She is an incredible woman and she has an incredible taste. And she understands something very innately that I love in films, which is faces, real faces. You know, it would be very easy to cast just beautiful young men in this film. And I'm not saying mine doesn't have them, but everybody's got a cool look. You know, you mm-hmm. think about Bo Knapp or Carl Glusman, even Toby Wallace, like all good looking guys, but they don't look, they're not just pretty faces, mm-hmm. unique faces. They've got unique qualities. And obviously I've made every one of my films with Michael Shannon, like this is a guy who I think is beautiful. I think he's incredible to look at, you know, incredible to photograph, but no one would, you know, probably consider him traditionally handsome. But that's because I don't really give a shit about that. That's just not very interesting to me. You know, I don't want a bunch of pretty people walking around. So yeah. For me, it's really about finding the character in those faces and then finding those faces that, you know, happen to be on a body that is incredibly talented. Because each of these actors, I mean, they're just stone cold badasses.
Yeah.
You can look at every frame of this film and you've got layers of actors, foreground, midground, background. There's somebody always doing something, you know?
Yeah. Well, they're probably going to kick us out of here. This might be our last one. But because of that, like, I want to talk about Austin, who I think is a real natural at a form of acting that I've kind of become fascinated with, which is this really quiet confidence, you know, like doing so much by doing so little. And we're still learning about what he's capable of, you know, but when you're editing him, you have to know how long you can keep on him, right? Before the audience might lose interest, and you never do with him. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Well, I mean, you know, the challenge on this film was, yeah, you don't want to cut away from any of them.
Yeah.
Then on the flip side of that, whenever you cut away from him, you get to cut to Tom Hardy or you get to cut to Jodie Comer.
Yeah.
It's a good problem to have.
So I don't want to leave, but I got to go because I want to go to this other person, you know, all these people. And I realized this early in my career with Michael Shannon. And it's not fair to normal human beings. But there are some people that when you put them in front of a lens, they're just captivating. There's something that they're doing inside. That is kind of seeping through the pores of their skin. Mike Shannon has it. Tom Hardy has it. Jodie Comer has it. Austin Butler has it. I've actually been really lucky in my career to work with a lot of people, you know, that have it. And it is, It's undeniable when you see it. You can't manufacture it. People just kind of come to the world this way. And you know, I think there's something about casting. I'm a big believer that there is the right person for the right part. Mm. And the deeper I get into my career, it is, in a way, it's harder because you have famous people, you know, ringing you up saying, "Hey, I want to work with you." And there's a reason they're famous, because they're all charming, you know, they're all totally engaging. Sure. And Francine jokes, like, I can't actually meet an actor or I'll cast them because I just like everybody and I love actors. But it's actually not true, because I believe that, not every actor can play every part, that there is actually a right part, which doesn't mean, you can't play against type. That's not what I'm talking about. You know, but there's an energy in around an actor in a certain point of time. And I've been really, really lucky and really, really kind of good at picking actors that there's an energy around them. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens, you know, I did it again. And in this case, when it comes to being able to work with Austin, mm-hmm. There's just an energy around that guy right now. And we are definitely trying to take advantage of it.
Look, man, we are tremendous fans of yours and your films. And so this is really special for us to have you on the show. Thank you for coming by.
Thanks, y'all. I appreciate y'all.
Thanks, man. Of course, dude. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Synovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
We want to thank Jeff Nichols so much for joining us on the show. Jake, I was talking about the fact that he is a first timer, and again, seems like someone strange to be a first timer, because we've had Michael Shannon come on the pod before and talk about his collaborations with him. Oh, also welcome Jake Hamilton to the show, joining us, Fox 32 in Chicago. Jake, the thing I wanted to bring up about talking to him was how it blew me away the way he responded to my question about The Outsiders, mm-hmm. and whether that was an influence over him, and for him to talk about how the opening couple of minutes of that Francis Ford Coppola movie was what he was trying to replicate with the bike riders. I wasn't expecting to, you know, sometimes you throw a pitch across the plate,
sure,
hoping to get a hit like
nothing.
That.
But no, I think it's interesting too, because, you know, filmmakers like, you know, around your age, Sean, are like getting to the point where like there are great filmmakers today, and you're realizing that, you know, in a day and age where so many people, you know, grew up and would name drop, you know, a Taxi Driver or a Godfather or, you know, mm-hmm. some of Hitchcock's earlier work, or maybe even going back to like Orson Welles, that now this new generation of filmmakers were raised on the exact same movies that you were raised on.
Right.
And I feel like they're probably used to hearing certain comparisons to be made. So to name drop something like The Outsiders, which mm-hmm. I would probably say probably isn't a movie that gets name dropped as an influence as much as maybe we think it should be, that had to probably be really refreshing for him.
But wasn't Sean was raised on like like Battleship Potemkin and like Citizen Kane and stuff like that. So I don't know.
He was on the Potemkin.
No, he was more raised on theater, like plays and like those kind of
right. I'll never forget
when he was in the theater with Lincoln. It was like, what was that sound?
He interviewed Shakespeare at the Globe Theater. Yeah.
I was the one demanding, like, am I going to get my money back for this ticket at the Ford Theater when the play got disrupted because that
I pictured
that idiot like jumped on the stage.
Sean is like going to review like a play, and he takes out this giant ass quill and he's like riding furiously, and you just see this giant quill flopping up.
Yeah, everybody get your laughs in.
I was very much like in the vein of complimenting your question, and then
you
I just died, and then
Thank
I just
you.
Boarded I boarded the Kevin McCarthy
I'm
train.
I'm clinging to the fact that my question worked
that was
really
a great
well.
No but that was my first time speaking with him.
Oh yeah, cool. Yeah. that's awesome. Well, and the funny thing about this too is for people who go see the bike riders, and Gabe is going to go see it the day after we record. Mm-hmm. It is a movie that feels like it was made directly for Gabe. Like,
oh God. Yes.
Because people might not know this. Gabe owns a motorcycle, rides a motorcycle. Feels like he belongs in that sort of throwback 60s culture.
Love that. And I love Jeff Nichols.
Growing his hair like a hippie. Yeah. It was one of these films where, because I know all the things that Gabe loves, as I was watching the movie and more things kept happening, I was like, oh my God, Gabe's going to lose his mind. Oh my God. And then finally, like, Michael Shannon shows up, and Gabe is a diehard Michael Shannon fan.
Hell yes.
And when he shows up, I was saying this to the guys, it's like rocket fuel into the movie. Yeah. Like the moment he arrives, and I was like, oh my God, Gabe's going to lose his mind.
I will say, speaking of Nichols and Michael Shannon, if anyone listening has never seen the movie Take Shelter, that is just an all timer.
And Midnight Special, right?
Midnight Special is amazing. Midnight Shotgun Special. Stories, his first film, is also fantastic.
Did he do Mud?
He did Mud, yeah.
Man, he has a great filmography.
I don't think he misses, man. He's
also, I feel like, what was his most recent one that I thought was, did he do like a more commercial movie before Bike Riders?
Loving, I think.
Yeah,
was the one
that's
that.
Loving
that's,
I think was that great.
This really is kind of, film. I think, his biggest commercial film. I think he was tied to something else with Scorsese at one point producing, but he's been pretty vocal about, like, he kind of was avoiding the studio system until he felt like he could make a movie he wanted and not get kind of swept up in that process. And so I think that's kind of why it's been a slow roll of his movies getting bigger and bigger. I think Mud was like the first big one where he had, you know, McConaughey attached to it, and it felt like a really big commercial success in that way. But I think he's slowly been sort of building up his filmography in a really, like, responsible way for that kind of filmmaker.
You mentioned Loving, and I have to bring up Ruth Negga, who is killing it on Presumed Innocent.
I was about to say, if you're not watching Presumed Innocent right now, you're missing maybe the best thing on TV right now.
How many episodes have you done?
7.
Yeah, I did all 7. Michelle and I ripped through them.
But here's and this is such a, like, Jake, shut up, I can't believe you're complaining about this. Right. Apple does this thing where they give you all the episodes of a show except the finale. And so the show starts and you're like all the way through. And now we have to wait for 2 months.
Like the normies.
Sean.
You should see my text thread back and forth with my Apple rep being like, dude, just give me the finale, man. Just give it to me. I need it. I need the finale.
Is Jake aware of the gas that was passed in that one episode?
He must be. Do you remember the attorney that looks like Hans Zimmer? Looks like Hans Zimmer.
Bill Camp? Okay.
Is that what his name is? Bill Camp? Yeah. How about the scene where I was telling Kevin about this, where he's working late at night and he gets up from and he just burps and farts? I'm trying to pitch Kevin on the show, and that was the only way I knew that he would now watch it.
Now I'm all in.
That's authenticity, baby.
I was like, Kevin, the performances are amazing. The script is great. Oh, wait a second. There's a port where a guy
gets
farts.
That's his awards reel.
I will say this in all seriousness, though. I watched the first episode. That guy is one of the best characters in the show.
Like, he's just really, like, great. And he's a great character.
He's a phenomenal character.
Does he not look like Zimmer? Am I wrong?
He looks like Zimmer.
And the crazy thing is, he's in a really amazing limited series called The Night Of. If you never saw The Night Of, he's brilliant in that. And in Presumed Innocent, he keeps using the because it's a very common expression, particularly in law enforcement and the legal system. The Night Of is a very common. So, but he keeps using that expression. I'm like, oh, that's the name of your show.
I interviewed when I did the interview for that. I don't know if I mentioned this last week, so if I did, just forgive me. But they did a really cool job with cutting that trailer together, because throughout the trailer,
you're talking about presumed innocent, not Night of.
Yeah, presumed innocent. Yeah, and he says over and over throughout the show, "I didn't do it. I did not do it." And I thought it was really interesting about the difference between somebody saying "I did not do it" versus "I didn't do it." There's an emphasis put on the "not" when you say it. And I asked the question, like, it came across almost like a grammar discussion. And then Sarsgaard picked it up. He's like, it's actually a lot more, emphasized if you actually say "I did not kill her." So when you're watching the show, for people watching it, pay attention to how Gyllenhaal says it, because he was very specific in each instance about how he said "didn't" or "did not." And that's supposed to be a way for him to kind of cue you in on what's going on in the actual mystery.
I would like to point out the difference in Kevin, my interview style, and that he goes into like deep into the catharsis of literary like conjunctures. And I'm basically like, hey, wouldn't it be funny if you guys remade Bubble Boy? I'd like to just emphasize the difference between...
I do like Bubble Boy.
I wish Kevin knew that that Bill Camp ripped a nasty part.
What episode is that in, Sean?
Two?
I don't remember. No, it's a little bit later, I think.
Okay.
It's a little bit later. Yeah. It's great.
I am now in the presumed innocent camp for sure.
It's really well structured.
I'm in the Bill camp. I will gladly join that show.
Quick, name his fan club. What do they call themselves?
Campers?
Campers, right?
That almost seemed too easy. I was like, that camp house would be the answer.
Gotta be campers. I learned recently that fans of Kaylee Spaney, I told Gabe this, they refer to themselves as Spaniacs. So I think it's terrific.
Mm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, huge fan of that. Yeah, yeah. I love her.
Spaney's in Romulus, right?
She is.
Yeah.
I hear about that movie, I think we're due for an all-timer alien.
Someone I know pretty well went to a footage thing today where Fede Alvarez showed like 15 or 20 minutes of footage. It sounds like it was
incredible. To that
incredible.
See, that holds no interest to me. Like, why would you want to see just 30 minutes? Like, that sounds like I would. There's another movie this summer that they're talking about potentially maybe just throwing it's only showing us 30 minutes, and I have no, just don't show me the
Horizon
movie.
Is it Horizon?
We'll talk about Horizon next time.
I don't know if the people know this. So Jake, on the opening weekend of Horizon, Jake, we're gonna, and also just to plug, we're gonna have Kevin Costner join us for a 45 minute like, oh, yeah, all encapsulating interview about his career, and he loved Sean and I. And so I think I want to mention that Jake's now doing a marathon. So Jake, you've committed to this, right? So Friday, Saturday, Sunday of the release, you're going to go twice a day, right?
Yes.
Okay. Until the horizon, the sun goes down and everything.
It's going to be, you're going to hear me chanting in the front row. Give me chapter two.
And the presumed innocent finale.
And the presumed innocent finale.
It's actually the surprise post-credit scene is just chapter two. And they just start playing chapter two.
You're not that far off.
Only for Jake.
You're not that far off, though.
Quickly, around the horn, Bike Riders. I thought Bike Riders was cool as hell. I really dug the vibe of it. I really enjoyed the story. When I tell you guys that, like, it felt like The Outsiders to me, it felt like a throwback to this time in the 50s and 60s. When the concept of these really close knit gangs, quote unquote, I guess they do sort of go around and get into trouble and, you know, break the law. And
is it Easy Rider vibes at all?
No,
like Nicholson.
There's a really interesting moment, because you have to keep in mind, like, this is based on a very real biker gang based out of Chicago.
Yeah. Okay.
And
why is every movie based in Chicago? Every single thing, Presumed Innocent, this is Chicago. Austin. Like, every single thing. Jake's like, Kevin, it's in Chicago. I'm like, how is every story ever in the history of movies take place in Chicago?
I know.
Dark Knight was shot in Chicago. It's like, anyways, continue.
And that's where Batman happened.
Come to DC.
That's exactly right.
De Niro's actually shooting in DC tomorrow.
Sure, there have been a thing or two shot in DC.
No, I know. De Niro's actually here right now shooting something tomorrow. I don't remember the name of it.
Oh, nice.
Look it up.
We got Shallow Hal shot here.
Nice.
Talladega Nights.
Shallow Hal.
Yeah, and Talladega Nights.
Shallow Hal. Wow.
Jakey, you were saying, sorry.
Oh, I forgot. Honestly, I lost my train
of
thought.
You were on the Bike Riders. Jakey, your thoughts on the Bike Riders, whether or not it has Easy Rider vibes.
Oh, okay. Here's why I would say that's a tough question to answer, because there's very much this question, I think, that the movie asks, because the biker gang that is represented in the film is a very real Chicago biker gang. And so it's basically talking about like a chicken or the egg, where it's just sort of like, to what degree did the biker culture influence movies like Easy Rider? And then to what degree did movies like Easy Rider come out and then influence the biker culture? So I think it's less of like saying whether or not the movie's like Easy Rider, and more about the fact of like which influence which, so much so that there's a, and this isn't well, there's an Easy Rider reference in the movie is what I'll say. And I think that's a very telling reference. And as if you just listen to the interview, you know that we spoke with Mr. Nichols about it. But there are certain genres.
I'm going to cut you off. Easy Rider is like the go to biker movie that I always think of my dad showed me as a kid. And so I'm sorry for cutting you off, Jake. But I just wanted to say that because like it's interesting about like. That is the like quintessential one I point to when I think of bike riding movies.
So about 10 years before Easy Rider, Brando did a biker movie in the 50s. It was very much sort of a clean cut kind of sort of greaser. I forget the name of it because I brought it up in the interview with Nichols. And it's interesting. They're two wildly different biker movies. And again, that's also sort of a study of like, where, like, who was it that these bikers wanted to be? And did they watch pop culture and kind of adjust their image? Or was pop culture watching them and then adjusting their image? And what happened in those 10 years that we went from the clean cut Marlon Brando biker to sort of the grungy pot smoking bikers of Easy Rider? There's a lot to say about that. That being said,
well, America changed.
There you go. That's a great truth.
Sure.
I very much liked the movie. I am a little bummed that I didn't love it. I feel like it's got all of the ingredients for a movie that I should love. And I feel like the whole time I just kept going, kind of like you, this is really cool. I dig this movie. This is awesome. And that should be fine. Sure. Like we should never knock a movie for just being good. Like these days, good as I'll take good.
I think I gave it 4 stars.
Yeah. I think
four
I would,
out of five.
I think I'd probably do like 3.5.
Okay.
For me, to me, a 7 sounds sexier than a 3.5. You know, they're the exact same thing.
I want to say this though. Like there's this current crop of the movie stars, the young movie stars, and to me, this does for Austin Butler similar to what Challengers did for Zendaya. It shows something completely different, right? Like it's a real detour from other things that he's done. And so now, when you put together, like for a while, his body of work was like largely Elvis, and now you've got Elvis, Dune Part Two, this, and now I'm like, oh, okay, I get, like I get what people are trying to get at now.
Well, you know,
like I see his range, I see what he's trying to do.
An extension of that, last week that Brat Pack documentary came out.
Oh, I want to watch that.
Talking about it in the newsroom about like there was the Brat Pack, and you know, and then obviously there was the Rat Pack in the '60s, and then we kind of had the quote unquote Frat Pack with Vince Vaughn and Will Ferrell and all those guys
in the
2000s. Like, is the next wave of whatever our pack is it Butler and Chalamet and Zendaya and Florence Pugh? Like, is that our half of the Dune cast? Like, is that our next? Because we haven't had one in a while. If you think about
it, it's been a while. Yeah, I think so.
Isn't that kind of exciting that like we're kind of on the verge of like that next great cusp of great actors?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends who's in it, you know, like
honestly, Chalamet, Butler, Zendaya, Florence Pugh, that Paul Mescal they're talking about.
Jacob Elordi, I think they put in there.
Sydney Sweeney.
I also think a lot of these actors who've been around for a while are finally starting to get their due, like Cillian Murphy, for example. Yeah. Like he's now become, not that he hasn't been big for a while, but I think a lot of these actors like Cillian Murphy are now becoming a star, like an A-list star in a way.
Let me ask you this. How much of it has to do with the fact that there's no longer as much pressure on a young actor to be in a Marvel movie? Where like it's not as big of a deal to be in a Marvel movie
anymore. A lot. Yeah, probably.
Because I feel like all these actors are making really interesting choices, and most of them really aren't going down the. I mean, yes, okay, obviously Zendaya is, but like.
So do you think that system a little bit chewed up some, like I'm thinking of like an Emily Blunt, you know, or someone like that who wasn't really associated with a quote unquote pack. Like they were just,
You know, Anne Hathaway never really wasn't. Never really got into the franchise. I mean, I think it's, and this is a conversation for another day, but I think it's very telling that for many actors in the MCU, like outside of their Marvel character, they haven't been able to open a movie.
Yeah, there was somebody who said the other day, though, I think it was like Variety or The Wrap, and they were like, if Scarlett Johansson gets into the Jurassic Park franchise, maybe she'll finally have a winning franchise. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, are you, did you just overlook the fact that she was a founding member of the Avengers? Like, what are we talking about here? So I don't know. It is an interesting sort of transition because I do think there's becoming more of an emphasis on movie stars than we have had for the past 20 years. You know,
I agree with that. Definitely more people going to see. Especially coming off the wave of Tom Cruise is our last great movie star. Like, we're now at a point where, you know, Chalamet's last few movies have been big.
Well, and it's generational. Like, my kids as an example and their friends, you know, they might know Tom Cruise, but they're not going to Tom Cruise movies really, you know? So it's like, who are they going out to see? PJ and Taylor they love Anyone But You. They're super into, you know, Glenn Powell, Sydney Sweeney, whatever those two go do, them as a couple will probably go follow Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney wherever they go. It's cyclical. It's generational. Yeah, exactly. It's the next, you know.
And then old man on my porch shaking the fist going, but Tom Hanks, though.
All right. Anyway, let's start to a quick ad break. And on the other side, we're going to talk about the box office and how things aren't as bad as we made them out to be.
Jake, everybody would go to the theater to see You've Got Gmail.
Oh.
And we are back. Okay, so 2 weeks back to back, we've been able to celebrate films doing well at the box office after a tough May, essentially. A couple of movies opening well, you know, but nothing really catching fire the way that we would expect in the summer season. Inside Out 2 came out this past weekend, and domestically did $155 million. $155 million. Let me repeat that. Internationally, excuse me, $140 million. For a worldwide take in its opening weekend of $295 million as of the statistics that we have right now, close to $300 million. Insane. I mean, the types of numbers that we are used to seeing. Why? Who the hell knows? I don't know. It was well-reviewed. You know, we anticipated the families were going to want to go back out to the movie theaters to go see it. It's a familiar franchise from a familiar brand. So all of these things sort of factor in. But, you know, now that we pair how Bad Boys Ride or Die, and Bad Boys Ride or Die had really good hold. I think it only dropped 30% or something like that. So, you know, that's doing incredibly well. So the question becomes, were we overly focusing on the few lackluster weeks, or are we now overly focusing on two back-to-back good weeks? And what if Quiet Place Part One bombs or something like that?
Well, as life is in all business and everything, there are ebbs and flows, ups and downs. And like when Furiosa and Fall Guy didn't perform, it was like the end of like the movies were over, whatever. But then you got to look at the five highest grossing films of the year so far domestically: Dune 2, Godzilla, Kung Fu Panda, Apes, and now Inside Out is the fifth one already. Is crazy. But those are all films that made a lot of money. Also, Inside Out 2 is the first film to make over $100 million in its opening weekend domestically since Barbie. It's been 11 months since we've had a film open that large.
Holy God. That's crazy.
But I was talking about this on the air today. I think we are now in a state, a flowing state of great box office for the rest of the summer, because I don't know how Quiet Place will do. I think it will do decent numbers because that's a well-known franchise. People love Lupita. People love Joseph Quinn.
What's the horizon, though? Like, is the Yellowstone of it all with him in a Western? Like, does that have any sort of traction? Like, is that going to get anything?
I just think length is going to kill it.
Just going to kill it?
I think length is going to kill it.
I mean, it's no longer than Oppenheimer. It's not. So
but Oppenheimer had legs.
Forever. Oh, yeah. But I there's a couple things that I think are really fascinating. The Fall Guy Furiosa thing of it, I think we all just understood that those were films that did not interest audiences. The Furiosa came 10 years too late. And I think Fall Guy just didn't know how to tap in. Fall Guy was such an inside baseball movie. that we loved it from an industry perspective, but it was so inside. Like, there's an entire scene where they're filming a oner. I mean, I love that stuff, but I mean, I don't know if like audiences really, really grasped onto that.
Do you also think with Furiosa, it's been too soon since Fury Road?
No, I think it's been too long.
I don't think people really cared that much about. I think if it had been a Fury Road sequel and they'd gotten Charlize Theron and Tom Hardy back, then I think we're looking at an $80 million opening. I don't think people were interested in a prequel to Fury Road. I just don't think people care.
Right. July is going to be dominated by two movies, I think. Well, Twisters obviously is going to be. Was Twisters July?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Twisters will be big, but I think that's going to be bookended by these two films. Despicable Me 4 opens July 3rd.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how much money the Despicable Me franchise has made?
It's the highest grossing animated franchise of all time.
Insane. With number Minions, one. It's made $4.6 billion. $4.6 billion.
And think about merchandising. Like, and those stupid Minions.
I bet you Despicable Me opens up $150 million.
Probably.
Right now, I'm seeing tracking from the 14th. Says 65 to 85, and I feel like that's going to get crushed.
That's insane.
Especially showing what Inside Out can do.
Domestic opening, at least.
It's July 4th. What did 3 open domestically?
I'll take a look.
It's July 4th. So, that's a huge weekend.
So you have that on July 3rd, and then in between, I think you have Twisters. Then you have Deadpool and Wolverine. We shared an article in our thread the other day where there's an article, I don't know who to credit for this, but there's a early tracking that's saying it's going to open up between 200 and 240 million domestically in its opening weekend. Did you guys also see today that, well, Sean sent it in the group with the China release? Mm-hmm. Domestic open for Despicable Me 3 was 72 million. But Deadpool now, you know, it easily makes a billion, right? There's no question on that. I mean, Deadpool 1 and 2 made almost 800 million. Yeah, at least worldwide.
I think 2 is in play. I think 2 billion is in play. Easily.
What's the highest grossing R-rated film of all time?
I don't know if the R-rated makes a... I guess it does.
I wonder what other movies are going to benefit from kids buying tickets to PG-13 movies so that they can sneak into an R-rated.
But you can't
sneak in anymore. Like, that's become more difficult because of the whole choose your seat thing.
Oh, that's interesting. Are we the last generation that was able to sneak into?
They do put the chart up. I mean, again, I'm not telling people to, you know, do what you got to do, but they do put the chart up usually, I think, at most theaters where you see where the vacant seats are.
I'll use a little personal anecdote that just happened to me recently. I wanted to go see Bad Boys Ride or Die, and Warner Brothers gave me a code to go see Watchers for an interview that we were potentially going to do. So I went to go see Watchers at 5:30, and then I was like, okay, I'm at the theater. I'm just going to go to the next screening of Bad Boys Ride or Die. And I was looking at, like, during the end credits of Watchers, as soon as it ended, I pulled up the app and I looked to see what was available in the seating for Ride or Die. And I saw like a row that had empty seats, and I was like, all right, I'm just going to go in there and sit in those seats. Right. But at my theater, they didn't put on the outside of the doors what movie is playing in each place.
Yeah.
And the theater that ended up having Ride or Die was right next to the woman who was taking the tickets. So I had to go out to the lobby and buy a ticket for Ride or Die and go in. They figured out how to stop me from sneaking into the theaters. But this is, as a teenager, I did that all the time. Yeah. That's all I do is bounce from theater to theater. But they've come up with these different ways to prevent you from
Sean. I hate to go see a movie.
I know.
No.
But
I did five in one day when Phantom Menace came out. I saw Phantom Menace at like at noon, and I was at the theater till midnight. It must have been the whole nine yards, and they analyzed that or something, whatever it was, but there was a bunch of them out at the time. Okay, real quick, R-rated worldwide grosses of all time. Joker is number one with a billion. Oppenheimer is number two. Wow. 976 million. Deadpool 2 is 785, and Deadpool 1 is 782.
So only one R-rated movie has ever cracked the billion-dollar mark.
I guess
that's
the R-rating will really hurt it.
So Deadpool 3 is going to.
I think
2 is going to be harder than you're giving it credit for. I think 2 billion is going to be tough.
I didn't think about the R-rated, but I think that's legit.
Billion and a half.
I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, maybe.
It has nothing behind it, like nothing significant behind it.
It's all people love Jackman's Wolverine.
That's the thing I think is, we're talking a lot about Deadpool as Deadpool, which I think everyone's excited about. But Jackman back is like this thing no one expected. and kind
in
of
an R-rated movie.
Regretfully once. Yeah, yes. Exactly.
And they're doing a really good job of keeping the rest of the movie hidden.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
everything that we've seen in the marketing is like the opening 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So
I can't wait.
Once people figure out like what else is happening in this movie based on stuff I'm hearing kind of thing, like it's going to be a juggernaut. No pun intended.
It's going to be huge.
Is he in it?
But then again, this is the, so Kev, you're in with the ebbs and flows of the box office and that neither thing is true. We're not all the way back. We're right. also not completely ruined.
But we're in a flow state right now. We're in a good flow.
But I also do think that they're going to, that the industry as a whole has to readjust
yes.
what the realistic expectations are. Like gone are the, you know, multiple weekends of 100 million opening, you know, 120. Like that's just not happening.
There anymore. Also used to be this idea in society that like going to the movies was a thing that we were always going to do. And it didn't really matter what was coming out. It was more about we're going to go to the movies, open the paper and let's see what's playing.
Sure.
Now it's this thing is coming out that I really want to go see. And I'm going to wait until that comes out.
Sure.
I think what this summer has taught us so far is if the right movie comes out, people will go. Same mm-hmm. thing like when Barbie and Oppenheimer came out on the same weekend, it wasn't one of them cannibalizing the other. It was an example of two movies came out that people really wanted to see. And guess what? Both of them did incredibly well. I think all that May showed us was there were a couple of movies that came out in a row at a time when we were expecting people to go to the movies and yeah. people almost basically universally rejected them. They said, no, I don't want to see that. And everyone panicked about the nature of movies. I think we just need to be worrying more about what movies we're putting out because yeah. I think people will always go to the movies. And mm-hmm. yes, there is this mentality now of like, okay, I'll wait. I think it's just a matter of making movies that remind people of what it is that they love about going to see something on the big screen because people will go, but yeah. you got to give them a reason to. And May didn't give them a reason to.
It's also really important to note what happened to Pixar during the pandemic.
Sure.
All the
films they convinced people to just wait and watch it at home.
Right. So like Soul, Turning Red, Luca, I think.
Onward, I think was the last time. I think that was the last one.
Right. So you basically almost told an audience. Well, I mean, obviously, we're in the middle of a pandemic and there's a lot more things to be seriously worried about, of course. But when you condition an audience in a way, they go, oh, the next Pixar film, we're just going to hit Disney Plus. You almost forget that you need to go to a theater to have these experiences with these bigger ones. And I think Inside Out 2 was kind of that they needed this so bad to understand that, oh, the brand is still strong. People will still go to the theater to see it if it's the right one. But there was probably a lot of audience out there who thinks, oh, I'll just wait for Disney Plus.
I thought that Pixar was going to have to make an announcement before Inside Out 2.
Yeah.
Like to the trades or something that just say, This won't be on Disney Plus until December.
Yeah.
For like a month, like 5 months or something like that. Yeah. Whatever.
And they didn't even have to, you know, they didn't even have to do that. But I would have been smart to them to say, like, we don't have a plan to put this on streaming until
December. And they almost didn't need to. It just kind of hit the right time.
What kind of legs do you think it has? Do you think it catches or does Despicable Me sort of cut that short?
I think the box office is a great story for it. And I've actually had two or three people in my newsroom come up to me today and go, okay, should I go see it? Like, I love the other one. Like, should I go? And I was like, yeah, you should probably go.
Those family movies are able to, sometimes able to just, like, the families keep going back because it's working for the kids or whatever it is. It's it's a great thing all summer to do. I'm curious to see if it picks up.
But, I mean, $300 million, you know, out the gate is
pretty good.
Outstanding.
I think the last one did, like, $880 worldwide.
And won an Oscar.
That was 2015. So
that's impressive.
I mean, you think it makes to a billion?
Oh, let me tell you what trailer I saw before we saw. We went to go see Inside Out 2 last night as a family. And before the movie, they had the first time I had seen any footage from this. Harold and the Purple Crayon. Folks.
Oh, is this the If prequel?
I mean, I don't feel like that's what it kind of wants to be.
Yeah.
Zachary Levy needs to rethink his choices.
Doesn't it look like there's a lot of things you could be talking about?
Doesn't it look like If?
Isn't
there a purple monster in it?
Yeah, kind of.
It's got a pretty good cast.
Yeah.
Alfred Molina's the narrator.
I haven't seen anything, so I can't really say anything negative
when
about it.
It just selling point just looks like a, for a movie is Alfred Molina is the narrator. That's pretty good. Not Alfred Molina's in it, because Alfred Molina is a damn good
the narrator.
It's great. Alfred Molina is the narrator.
Yeah. So I actually thought that August looked a little thin, but maybe not. It's got August has M. Night Trap to start it off as Borderlands, which again we saw a trailer for that last night too, and that just it just wants to be Guardians of the Galaxy.
Video game properties have been killing it, man. Those
I know
showed up for
I know
it.
Yes, it does look that much of it. And then Alien Romulus,
and then the first
Jake's
weekend
Horizon
of
chapter
yeah.
two,
and then yeah. the first weekend of September is Beetlejuice.
Does Romulus do well?
I mean, I think it'll do well. It won't do like huge numbers, but it's going to do pretty well. That franchise has
it also too, like what is well?
Yeah, you know, like
well is subjective.
Gets to 100.
And also, like, you know, did he make it on the cheap? Like did he find out, you know, it doesn't seem like it's the big budget $100 million Prometheus movie. It seems like it's old sure. school practical sets kind of thing. Yeah. So, you know, if it's a $80 million horror movie and yeah. opens to 35-40 and legs out a little bit.
I don't have a good resource for this at the moment, but a budget I'm seeing reported online was a production spend of $40 million.
I was going to say, if it's right in that wheelhouse of 35 to 40.
Then, and if it makes its budget back opening weekend, boom, for an R-rated movie, well done.
I mean, an R-rated alien movie that's touting itself as a mixture of the first two films brought to you by this generational horror talent. Like, I mean, is any horror fan not going to show up for that? You know, like,
no, yeah. I mean, I'd imagine that the Warner Brothers is, or I guess Universal is hoping that that's the same line of thinking for Mike Flanagan and The Exorcist.
I rewatched Alvarez's Evil Dead the other day.
It's so good.
It's so brutal. It's like an hour and 25 minutes of just relentless brutality.
The Red Band trailer for that movie is so good.
Yeah. I actually think Evil Dead Rise is better.
Nah, I think my issue with Evil Dead, and I actually liked Evil Dead Rise quite a bit. To me, Evil Dead just has to be set in the woods.
See, that's why I like Evil Dead Rise so much.
It feels unnatural for me to be
apartment complex.
Yeah.
Evil Dead Rise is in the apartment complex in the city, and to me, it's
Remember
not
the
an
opening?
Evil Dead. Oh, the opening's great. The opening's great.
Was that in a lake? The opening was in a lake.
The opening was in a cabin in a lake. And to me, like an Evil Dead, there's something. It's unnatural to not have Evil Dead in the woods. That being said, like Army of Darkness clearly is its own thing, but yeah.
So good.
I also want to alert everybody that when we saw the Borderlands trailer, I turned to Michelle and I said, that movie so badly wants to be Galaxy of the Guardians.
Yeah.
And then I worried that I might be having a stroke.
Yeah.
So I'm getting old is what I want to let everybody know. And one day I might not be here. So appreciate you all here. All right. We're running out of time.
Jesus Christ.
I'm just appreciative of your fart knowledge for today, so thank you for
Kevin. Please start binging Presumed Innocent until
now. I'm all
and Zimmer lets out a massive fart. It's outstanding. Here's your call to action.
Like
folks.
It sounds like the beginning of Dune.
it's the Inception horn.
It's a Zimmer's fart.
It's the Inception horn, of course.
That's great. Head to the comments down below of this week's episode and let us know if you guys think that Pixar should be focusing on original ideas or sequels. I don't want the takeaway from the success of Inside Out to be like part two, part three, part four of everything. Jake, you are muted. I don't know if you're trying to say something.
Do not make about to get Toy Story 5. Wally 2. Don't do Wally 2.
We are about to get Toy Story 5.
Either. Yes.
So let us know. Should Pixar focus on original ideas or sequels? In the meantime, follow us on social media at Jake Stakes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean _ O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach on the show. Is at
7.0
Real Blend. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. We've got a couple of really fun interviews coming up. And in the meantime, or until then,
Dunkirk.
I'm going to say Tim Burton.
I'm going to say.
Come on,
know.
Sean, it's a short show.
Sean's got anything.
Do the Levi movie.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.